I'm a big fan of the quiet scenes between battles. And again, it's a thing that's very much inspired by video games like Final Fantasy and Mass Effect. And that's kind of like the quiet moments where they're all sitting around a fire and talking and reflecting and laughing and joking and making fun of each other and getting kind of vulnerable with each other. Those are by far my favorite scenes. And I think they're the scenes that throughout the book, as long as you make them interesting and don't make them seem like lulls, they do so much to further a character and to make the moments where they're in dire straits seem more dire.
Welcome to Speculative Sandbox, your audio playground for creative storytellers. My name is Vicky Lawn, and each episode, I and a guest will unpack a fiction trope with an eye for character development and narrative structures. Make sure to look for Speculative Sandbox on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter, where you can join the conversation. Leave comments or questions, or let us know what other tropes we should cover. When the real world just doesn't cut it, let's get lost in a fictional one.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi everyone, this is the first episode of our spring 2023 season, and we're starting out with a bang. Nicholas Eames, award-winning author of Kings of the Wild and Bloody Rose, joins me today to talk about ensembles. We dive deep into Kings of the Wild to discuss character arcs and motivations, how to balance the plot between an ensemble cast, and the ways he used 70s, 80s, and 90s band metaphors to inform his characters. This is a perfect episode for writers out there working on their own ensemble casts. Nicholas Eames, thank you so much for joining me on Speculative Sandbox. I have to do a shout out to my local indie bookstore, which is called Stacks Book Club. They had your book, Kings of the Wild, prominently displayed on their pop-up, and I saw it and I grabbed it and loved it. So I'm just honored to be here with you. So thank you for being here.
Wow. Please thank them on my behalf as well. Yeah, that's great.
So we have a couple listeners that are really excited to hear from you that have read your work. But for those that, you know, are kind of getting introduced to you right now, can you introduce yourself and talk about some of your projects?
Sure. Yeah. My name is Nicholas Eames. I have two books out at the moment, Kings of the Wild and Bloody Rose. Both are part of a series called The Band. And while they do have kind of an arc that runs through them and will kind of conclude in a third book, they are totally standalone stories. So you could technically read the second one first. They take place in a setting where mercenary bands are kind of the equivalent of rock bands. So they gather in groups of four or five men or women. They have managers that book them gigs, but those gigs are to slay dragons or save towns and do whatnot. In between those gigs, they drink and smoke and act like hooligans, pretty much like bands of our modern day and past. And that's kind of sort of the premise, but ultimately the stories are kind of about family and found family. So,
yeah, I love that. I was very amused when that theme started to kind of unfold of the music industry. And it's such a perfect fit. Like, you took two worlds and mashed them together and it makes so much sense. And I enjoyed it a lot.
Thank you for saying so. Yeah, it is very, it's very much a shtick, and it kind of sounds like an idea that a stoner might come up with and then never write. But I think it works really, really well, because I mean, mm-hmm. if you played monsters, why wouldn't you get famous for doing it? So
exactly. Yeah. Okay, so I have some rapid fire warm up questions for you before we kind of go into the theme of today's episode, which is okay. All right, so they're related to the theme. So for Kings of the Wild is a loving homage, not to just to fantasy novels, but rock concerts. So what is your favorite band? Who's your favorite musician?
That definitely changes a lot. Sorry, this won't be as rapid fire, but yeah,
it
changes a lot. Depending on what genre music I'm listening to, like for Kings of the Wild, I listen to all 70s stuff. For Bloody Rose, it was all 80s stuff. For the third book, it's all 90s stuff.
Awesome.
But standouts among them, Led Zeppelin, obviously, is somebody I really fell in love with while writing Kings of the Wild. And then Meatloaf, you know, Always and Forever. Boy, oh boy, those songs were phenomenal.
That's awesome. If you were in your own band or ensemble of friends, how would you characterize your friends and your own role?
Ooh, that's a great question. God, I really don't know though. It's funny. You know, I'd like to think I'd be the Clay Cooper, if you will, even though for those who haven't read the book, he's kind of like the, you know, the glue that holds it all together, but I'm probably the Moog, who is technically the one that makes all the jokes.
Nice.
Yeah.
Would you give yourself like a specific power?
Well, God, yeah. No. I don't know. I'm pretty good with a bow, actually, believe it or not.
That's awesome. Okay.
Yeah, I had a bow as a kid and I practiced a lot. And by the time archery in high school came along, my teachers were like, what the hell have you been doing?
You were born in the wrong time. You could have existed back then. Okay. Let's say that you are a background character in a fantasy story. What is your occupation and what information would you give the main character?
I would probably be a bard, which, you know, looking back on it, that's probably what my answer to the previous question should have been. And yeah, I would just, you know, tell them some stories, pump their tires, warn them of danger, you know, the usual stuff.
Would you travel with them on their gigs?
I probably would. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. That I really enjoyed that. I think you go into a little bit with like bards and how dangerous it is for them because they're not exactly action heroes.
Yeah. Yeah. The bards are, they came about from, have you ever heard of the movie This Is Spinal Tap?
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah.
It's kind of like one of the OG kind of like mockumentary movies, kind of like Best in Show. It's got a lot of the same people. And it's about rock and roll. And there's a kind of running joke in it where the band's drummers always die mysteriously and no one knows why or even cares to really investigate too deeply. And that was kind of where the bards joke came from. It's like their bards attached to the main band in the main book just keep dying over and over and over. They're just like, oh, we'll get another one.
Yes. It's so funny because you're a writer, you're reading a book that's a product of your writing, and I'm all right reading. It's like an inside joke. It's really kind of tongue in cheek.
Well, thank you.
All right. So let's get into the topic. The general topic is about ensembles. I think a lot of our listeners who are interested in your interview might be writing ensembles of their own, and they really are interested in learning how you balance the characters and how they all feed into the overarching story. So using Kings of the Wild to kind of guide that, I have the plot description, so I'll read it here. Mm-hmm. Clay Cooper and his band were once the best of the best, the most feared and renowned crew of mercenaries this side of the Heartwild. Their glory days long past, the mercs have grown old, fat, drunk, or a combination of the three. Then an ex-bandmate turns up at Clay's door with a plea for help, the kind of mission that only the very brave or the very stupid would sign up for. It's time to get the band back together. So we're going to be going into character arcs, story structures. So I anticipate spoilers, but I'll leave it to you, your comfort level on what kind of spoilers to give. And of course, for those listening, definitely get the book if this interests you. I find it to be really fun and also informative. So let's get started. I listed the characters. I have like an order I just kind of randomly came up with, but do you have a preference?
Oh, no, you go for it.
Okay. So we have Clay Slowhand Cooper, who is the kind of like the heart and voice of this book. He's the one that opens it up. He's big, he's intimidating, and he's very happy with his simple life as a husband and father. So can you talk about what you thought of Clay and his purpose for the story?
Sure. Well, Clay, I don't know why I decided to focus on him as the main character, to be honest. But when I wrote those first three chapters of the book, which I wrote them and then I put it aside for a year to go work on something else and just kind of always thought, oh, that was a pretty good beginning. And ultimately, in the end, those three chapters were never altered or edited in any significant way. It had that comforting feel that starting listening to that set, the 70s music, was kind of giving me a kind of a homey, folksy kind of vibe. And so each member of the band in Kings of the Wild, at least, is sort of representative and inspired by a typical member of a rock band. So with like the leader of the band, who technically really isn't Clay, being kind of the lead singer, but Clay represents the bassist of the band. And the bassists, when you like read about rock or learn about rock or even just common knowledge, are often the least recognized members of a band. Mm-hmm. Everyone knows the lead singer, everyone knows the lead guitarist. Sometimes you even know the drummer, but you kind of just space on the name of the bassist. And that kind of inspired Clay Cooper's character. He is without the bassist in a band, there is no kind of heartbeat to the song, you know, but it's the least glamorous position often. And so that was kind of the motivation for his character to be kind of like almost like a backseat in a way, and be able to look around at the other characters in the band that are a bit more vibrant than him, and to be kind of the voice of sardonic reason amongst them. So that was kind of my inspiration for him. And he also uses his weapon is a shield. Every character in the book kind of has a weapon that is their kind of bread and butter. And his is a shield, which as a character is in the book, not necessarily related to music whatsoever, represents his character and the fact that he's there to protect people and to, you know, to look after his friends, as opposed to just hurt people.
Yes. Well, and you did something really remarkable in the first couple of chapters that helped establish that heart, that foundation that he serves, because he's the one that has something to lose. So Golden Gabe shows up at his door and says, help me with this quest. And Clay's like, I have a family, I have a daughter, I have a reason to stay here. Mm-hmm. But then you have a moment between him and his daughter that makes him realize he needs to go help his friend save his daughter, because he would hope that a friend would do the same for if he lost his own daughter. Yeah. And that was such a tender, emotional moment that I thought was such a nice way to kind of balance with the more, you know, roar, you know, battle mentality, because it kind of shows that there's emotions to this. And I find that like metal, there's a lot of emotion in metal. It can sound really loud and aggressive, but there's emotion under all of it. So I thought that was a really nice way to open the story.
Yeah, me too. And ultimately I'm pretty sure that scene is kind of what hooked my agent and my editor the first time they read it. So, and hopefully any reader that reads it, you know, if you don't like it by the time you get to the end of chapter 3, then don't bother, I would say.
Yes, because it does tell you what you're in for. And another character that was always making me get emotional was Moog, because he had such a tender storyline. But we'll get to him in a minute. Okay, Golden Gabe, the instigator in this book. He's the one that needs help saving his daughter. He's very, you know, he's golden. So tell me about him.
Well, Golden Gabe represents the front man of the band, the leader, the kind of loud, brash voice of it, with his long golden hair and charisma. So he's kind of like the conniver. He draws everyone to him. And oftentimes, when you look at the aftermath of these bands, when they go their separate ways, it is the lead singer that has the most, you know, dire straits afterwards. Not always, but the other ones are sometimes a bit more even keeled, where maybe because of the fame attached to the lead singer, their life goes a little more awry. So that was kind of the idea behind him. He'd had a great life, and obviously he was very famous, but he kind of got himself into trouble, had a lot of bad habits, and was in retrospect not like maybe the best father he could have been. So this is also very much a story of him trying to atone for the father he's been, and just to be a better person. And but he knows that he can't be that person without the people that made him that, which are his bandmates. So hence his quest to go gather them all.
Do you think by being kind of the lead, the front man, the lead singer, that you tend to kind of cling to your past more? Do you see that in Golden Gabe?
Oh, it's quite possible, only because those are the people that, you know, that got the most famous. So I think you could probably look for the similar things in like, you know, a sports team. Whoever was the biggest player on the sports team got the most famous, and afterwards make look back on their life and like think of those as the glory days. Whereas someone who had a bit more an even life, you know, might they go, oh, that was nice, but I also like what I have now. Whereas I think the leader of a band is more likely to kind of look back fondly on those days when he was like a god among men, you know?
Yes. So it's just those two for a little bit initially. And then they run into, and this is where my memory fails me. Is it Moog that they run into next or Skull Drummer?
Moog is next.
Moog. Yeah. Okay. That's what I thought. So he's a wizard and he has a very personal reason to go on this quest. So can you go into him a little? I love him. He's my favorite. He's just so interesting. So yeah, tell me all about him.
Yeah, sure. Well, Moog is an interesting character the way he ended up in the final story, because he is a wizard. He had a husband that died of this kind of incurable disease, and he has worked tirelessly since the band broke up to try to find a cure for that disease. So he lives in a tower and kind of lets life and love pass him by. He is, when they meet him, he's wearing a one-piece pajamas with like stars and stripes on it. I want him to make him, you know, sort of a typical wizard, but in a funny way. And as opposed to Clay, when Clay is like, you know, when Gabe first asked Clay to come along on this adventure, Clay's like, absolutely not. And Moog is like, absolutely. Because he misses his friends, and it's not in him to say no to a friend at all, ever. However, Moog also has contracted the disease, which he is trying to cure. So, you know, he goes on it and maybe in hopes of finding a cure for it in the Heartwild, which is this massive poisoned forest, where he kind of contracted the rot in the first place. However, he did not have that disease in every draft of the book until the very final draft of the book.
Yeah, you revealed it later too. Like, it wasn't like an immediate revelation. Yeah. But I really like that, because by then you've already kind of hooked into him. You have an initial idea of what his motives are, and then you kind of get revealed. And it just, by then you've kind of fallen in love with him a little bit as a character, and you want the best for him because he's funny, you know, and then you find that, and then you're like, oh no, now you really want to keep reading and see what happens to him.
Yeah. Well, thank you for saying so. Yeah, he is. I mean, again, in that way, he is like definitely the funniest character of the book. He's the most lighthearted and positive and optimistic character, but he's the one that of all of them has the kind of the ticking clock over his own mortality. So.
Yes. Okay. Then that's followed by Matrix Skull Drummer.
Yep.
This is hilarious to me. So he is now a king, but he is very unhappy, and he has a very unfaithful marriage, which makes me think of the show Gavalant?
Gallivant.
Gallivant, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, Gallivant, where like he had a girlfriend and he thought he was very much in love, and she left to go be, I think, the queen of the king. And then you find out she's actually this vicious person. Yeah. But it got me thinking of that. So yeah, tell me all about Skull Drummer.
So Skull Drummer, he represents, I did forget to mention that Moog sort of represents like the jack of all trades in the band.
Okay.
You know, the band's got that keyboardist, not every band, but some bands have a keyboardist or the guy that plays the triangle or a weird instrument like that, or sets off the fireworks, and that's Moog. Matrick, on the other hand, as his kind of moniker suggests, represents the drummer. He fights with two knives, and you know, when describing his fight scenes and things like that, I tried to use as many words that you could also use to describe a drum solo. His demeanor, I think, is typical of a lot of drummers, kind of like the party hard kind of thing. He did get married to a queen that they saved, and now has five kids, none of which are his, and he despises his life. Although he does reflect later on in the book that, you know, and obviously his wife is not a sympathetic character necessarily, but he does reflect later on in the book that he doesn't blame her for, you know, having these affairs, because he was a shitty husband. She thought she was signing up to marry a hero, and she was really marrying a slob that was hailed as a hero. So he, of all people, doesn't blame her at all, and knows that he's as equally as at fault as she was in their failed marriage.
Yeah. So at this point, you have these different characters that represent passage of time. And in Skull Drummer's case, it's, you know, someone settled down, they went that route, they went awry, and they're dealing with that. Meanwhile, you have Moog, who isolated. You have Gabe, who, what would you say he represents his passage of time? Regret?
Well, maybe just even trying to keep the past alive. He would have been fighting mercenary fights. He would have been selling off, you know, his like, stuff to keep his, you know, debtors at bay, and just, you know, just trying to, yeah, sustained his lifestyle.
Yes, kind of still living in the past a little bit, but yeah. You know, good for him, right? Like it's a fun lifestyle. Yep. And then of course, Clay Cooper, he seems to like the life that he's established for himself seems to be the most stable, the most comfortable, the most to lose. And looking at all of up to this point, he is losing something, right? You have Golden Gabe who's going to earn something. Skulljammer is going to get out of his, you know, marriage and unhappiness. And same with Moog, who's isolated. But Clay is kind of different than all that. And did you do that because it just kind of fell, the cards fell that way? Or is it because Clay being the narrator had needed to be different?
Ultimately, yeah. I mean, and Clay's own character arc itself is kind of a balance between his kind of violent nature and the whole book really is about people that are informed by their past. Mm-hmm. And so he's very much a product of his mother and his father. His mother, who was kind of inquisitive and quiet and caring, and then a father who was kind of violent and aggressive. So he balances those two personalities between them. So obviously work being in a band, you know, he had to rely upon the traits that his father gave him. And then in his family life, he embraces the traits that his mother passed on, which he wants to embody more and more. A lot of his arc is about him going on this journey, but still trying to keep that part of himself that he's worked so hard to preserve, his kind of more peaceful nature. Mm-hmm. A lot of his character was, my own mom actually used to read us the poem If by Rudyard Kipling all the time. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with it or if a reader or a listener is, but it's very much kind of like, you know, if you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs. And it's kind of about maintaining calm amidst chaos. And and Clay very much, I was trying to make him kind of embody that poem as I was writing the book and his story.
When Golden Gabe gets Clay to join him and they first leave to go on their trek, it reminds me so much of The Hobbit, because you're going from this warm, comfortable place and then you're on the road and it's cold. And it always stands out to me, that dichotomy, that difference. So I just wanted to tell you that. I thought that was cool.
Well, thanks for saying so. The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings, obviously, it was a huge inspiration to me, and especially that idea, you know, the Hobbit's life, it's such a classic story of being in comfort and then going out on the road. Mm-hmm. And then even in the very last paragraph of the book, I didn't try to emulate it exactly, but I wanted to, with my last paragraph of the book, I wanted to give you the same feeling that the last line of Lord of the Rings gave me, you know, so.
Awesome. Yeah. Okay. So then Ganelon, am I saying that correctly?
Yep,
all
yep,
right. Yep. Ganelon is a very unique addition to this quest, because he's a man out of time. He got frozen in time a little bit and got released. And he's known for being quiet and taciturn, but dangerous. And he's very youthful compared to the rest, because he didn't get a chance to age. So that is really interesting. Tell me about you, what you thought of him.
Well, who knows how I came up with the idea in the first place, which goes for a lot of the ideas in this book. But he's a character who is literally frozen in the past. He got turned to stone for a crime he committed, and the band sort of like let it happen almost, or didn't maybe fight it as much as they should have in retrospect. And it was at a time when they were all kind of ready to go their separate ways, and he kind of took the fall for them in a way. So he got turned to stone, and he's been stone for 19 or 18 years. Then they go and thaw him out, as it were. He is, I think, a pretty interesting character. And he, because he's still in his prime, you know, and he sees what has become of all his bandmates and doesn't like it one bit. And so he, at least amongst when they have their first fight and all of them are, you know, creaking wheels and squealing doors, he's the only one that's still like a finely honed instrument and is willing to like pull them through the first few scrapes until they can kind of get their shit together.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's it's interesting because you notice the difference between the men who have had a chance to age and him, and the difference between youth and experience. And I thought that was interesting. So I guess asking you now, if you came across your younger self from 8 years ago, 10 years ago, would you feel that same difference too? Like, do you feel like there's been a big difference then between then and now?
Well, thanks to Facebook memories, I'm able to see him all the time. And boy,
they're embarrassing.
Is it? I know it is. That's pretty much the only reason I have Facebook, so I can go delete my memories when they come up and be like, oh, you idiot. And yeah, he was, I mean, the younger me actually is a lot more, not that I'm not pessimistic right now, but boy, I was so optimistic my whole life. As someone who wanted to be a writer, who was an aspiring writer, and had, at least when they started out, had no clue how difficult that road is. And that the mountaintop, once you get there, isn't necessarily a peak. It's just like, you know, base camp for Everest of a writing career. So it is interesting to look back at old me and see how positive and optimistic. And I honestly have nothing but respect for him, because boy, oh boy, I worked for another book for 10 years before giving it up and writing Kings of the Wild. And just kind of always, I definitely had a lot of setbacks, especially like, you know, submitting to agents and getting rejected, but I never kind of gave up. So, and I sure as hell didn't have eggs in any of her basket. So thankfully, yeah, I was just blindly, blissfully ignorant. And yeah, I had nothing but respect for that old Nick. I wish I could have his work ethic back, actually.
I can relate to that. I miss innocent Vicky from 4 years ago when I first decided to go on this journey. And I've gotten this far, but no book deal yet. My agent's working very hard. But it is that the innocence of youth when you don't know what you're getting into. And
yeah, exactly.
As a result, I felt like I was a lot more gung-ho. But once you know and you're more knowledgeable, you do move a little slower, more strategic, thinking first kind of thing. So all right. That was, to me, the main characters of this group. When I look up like other people's character summaries, some people include Larkspur. She comes in a lot later. Would you say that like, oh, I meant to ask you this first. Ganelon, what instrument does he represent?
Oh, so Ganelon is the axe man. So he literally wields a giant axe, and he is kind of the lead guitarist, the showstopper. Like, he's the big, you know. Yeah, ultimately the most talented of all of them.
Gotcha.
Okay, yeah.
And Larkspur is an enemy at first. So since people are including her as part of the group, even though she comes in later, like, what were your thoughts about that character?
Well, Larkspur was actually kind of inspired by a friend of mine. I had this friend named Devin who was reading the book. Kind of every three chapters, I would give her three chapters to read. And she'd kind of be like, oh yeah, this is great, and kind of pump my tires. So by the time I looked like, partway, I was like, oh, I should really put Devin in here somewhere. So that's kind of who she became.
Oh, okay.
In the book. And she's also like her character itself, her true real name is Sabatha, and purposely spelt. So it's kind of a reflection of the band Black Sabbath. A lot of the people in the group have kind of like bands associated with them as well. And yeah, she was just kind of like, it's a thing that I really, really, I find that I like now. And it's in features in both my books, is someone who's not like the ultimate antagonist of the book, but is sort of like a thorn in their side the whole time. Maybe a bit more sympathetic than the final antagonist in some cases. And so I really like that. And I'm going to maybe hopefully try to keep it going. So I think it's good to have a kind of another threat coming at the main characters. And
yes,
represents that.
Which of these characters do you identify with most?
Ultimately, it is. Oof, it's a cross between Clay Cooper and Moog. Clay Cooper, because, you know, he's got a very dry sense of humor, and he's optimistic but cynical at the same time. And because he embodies those qualities that my own mom tried to instill in me. So, you know, he's kind of like the best version of what I would like to be, or at least his good qualities. His best version is my best version, rather. And then Moog, just because Moog is just like, says anything that comes to his mind, is constantly making jokes, even when it comes to, like, you know, deflecting sorrow with humor. which is also very much one of my main traits. So Moog is a good, is a character, and he's another person that, or a tool that I use in the second book, and we'll be using the third as well, to have at least one character that can say literally any joke I want to try to get away with. And Moog's the one first book that can just go for it and see if it gets past the editors.
Yes. Humor and sorrow. It's funny because, you know, they're so opposite of each other, but they go together really well. Mm-hmm. I find that, for example, people that are going through trauma or dealing with issues might find comfort in humor. And so how did you find that balance between those two things?
Ultimately, my editors helped me a lot find it as well. Or find it, well, I don't know, that sentence didn't make sense. But my editors helped me tone that, balance the two sides rather, because I think in the very first draft of the book, there was probably a little bit more ridiculousness in there as well. And to be honest, when I first started the book, despite that kind of poignant opening chapters, I did mean it to be fun and funny and a book where you weren't necessarily that concerned about the lives of the main characters, like them dying at any moment. Rather, you're interested in them as characters, but you weren't like, oh my God, is this person going to get a sword shoved through them at any moment? Which in a lot of like the fantasy fiction, at least in the last 10 years before my book came out, that was it. Like everyone was dying in the end. And so it was meant to be funny, and then the poignant stuff just kind of crept in there by accident as you kind of got more attached to the characters. But there were stuff, and I think in the process of finding an agent and getting an editor, at first I had an agent and then a prospective editor that both wanted Moog toned down, or in the second case, right out of the book. Because he was kind of too ridiculous, and he was more like it's like a Terry Pratchett character put into a Joe Abercrombie or a Tolkien-esque world kind of thing.
I'm glad you fought for him to stay though.
Yeah, me too. And there was a couple scenes, maybe one scene I think that I did take out. But I mean, there's even a scene called that, I mean, you'll know it as soon as I say it, but it's called, like, we call it, refer to it as the boner scene. Mm-hmm. Where through some weird means everyone has erections at a certain time. And I remember when I first had a call with my agent, she was like, blah blah blah, I love the book, this and that, that scene does need to go. And I was like, great, sure, it's gone, you're right, whatever, like, you know, because I was saying whatever it would take to get an agent. And then as I was telling my friends that, they were like, no, you've got to fight for that scene, please do it. So I went back to her and I was like, listen, if I like just change some things around and restructure a few words, can I keep it? And she's like, well, I'll give it a shot and we'll see. So I did change it, took out a few words, like gestating, for instance, and she let me keep it in the end. And then there was a few scenes I think I maybe trimmed down because what my editors thought, but ultimately there was, you know, there's a scene where the five of the band walk abreast up a hill, and it's meant to be representative of one of those scenes in a movie where everyone's walking in slow motion side by side, and then Moog trips over his robe and falls, and all of them fall over top of him. And I remember they kind of wanted that gone, and I was like, no, that's got to stay. Mm-hmm. And even a scene where Moog is pulling food out of his magic hat and throwing it at people, and
I and love like, that.
Yeah, exactly. I fought for that scene too. I'm like, it's, you know, he's got to be a bit ridiculous. So
there's greatness and absurdity, especially given the setting. And there's so many fantasy novels out there, and to have those little kind of things thrown in, it just makes it so unique and fun. And that's my kind of humor anyway. So yeah. I appreciated that you fought for that.
Yeah.
Thank you. So now we have done our character descriptions. I have some character development questions now. These are more technical questions. So you didn't slam all these characters right in front of us straight out the gate. You did it with steady introductions. Each character feels unique. Each has their own motive. How did you do this?
Well, I think a lot of that, and it goes on in the second book too, although in the second book you meet the band all at once and then you kind of learn more about them as the story goes on. My book is very much a point A to point B story. You know, at the end of the first three chapters, where it's going to take place, where the climax is going to take place, because that's the whole point of the book. Mm-hmm. So I want to make the journey there as interesting as possible. And a lot of that comes in, like, you know, learning about the characters or having small, like, you know, them, you know, have to come to terms with things within themselves along the way. And I think a lot of that I learned from video games, believe it or not. I'm a huge fan of like the games Final Fantasy, and there's a big game, a series called Mass Effect that I love. And those games are phenomenal at, as the story goes along, using their characters as storylines, as opposed to just characters. And so I think that's probably something I took from that. And, you know, when you do that, I think it allows, not only does it make for compelling stories, but it, you know, makes the reader more attached to the characters as you go along.
It also helps people that are maybe new to the format or the genre. Like in a video game, you want people to kind of learn. There's a learning curve to it.
Yeah.
And by having Gabe in first, it's like, okay, we understand what you said, the stakes and the goal. And then as you each bump into each character, what I really liked about it though is something I'm always trying to do in my own work is you don't want each meeting to feel the same, right? You want to stay away from that feeling of repetition because then the reader gets bored. So I really liked the diversity in how they were all introduced. I thought that was a great approach. Now with your follow-up, you talking about introducing them all together and then breaking it out. So what was that like from a technical perspective as a writer doing it that way?
Well, there's challenges to both because in the first book, you have a band that all their like greatest moments are in their past. So you have to have them reminiscing about things in the past and not make the reader feel too left out about it, but make them feel like, oh, that sounds really amazing. And so in the second book, the band, especially because they represent more 80s bands, where in the 80s music was very much trying to emulate 70s stuff, but make it louder, bigger, better. And these people, like most of the bands in the 70s, say, came from very humble beginnings, recorded in very humble settings, started off like in a van together, and then maybe ended up in an airplane. Whereas in the 80s, they started off, you know, in a bus or an airplane and just went bigger and bigger. And so the second band in Bloody Rose is that you see them at first and you see them all as what their persona that they present to the world is. And then it's as you go, as the main character goes on the journey with them, you learn more about them and their who they are really, for better or worse, as you go along. So, and they're also, because Saga has the luxury of being, they're old guys, and you're sympathetic to them because they're old in a lot of ways, and they love each other, and they're mature. And so they're a lot easier to like, whereas, you know, if you went on tour with Axl Rose and Guns N' Roses in the 80s, you would hate them and you would think all these people are psychos. None of them are redeemable people. So writing a band that's in its prime, like, you know, and yet you look at something like Led Zeppelin now, they're all very even keeled, lovely gentlemen. They're knights, for God's sake. But at the time, you know, or look at the Rolling Stones nowadays, everyone just loves them. But and the Rolling Stones, when they were in their prime, were like arrested constantly. The police, like any the police today, protect them. Whereas the police back in their prime, like literally tried to arrest them at any chance they got. So writing a band in its prime and trying to make sympathetic characters is quite a challenge, I think. But you don't want to make them too sympathetic because it would be unrealistic. So
yeah, you mentioned your third book taking place in the 90s. What is your observation of musicians in the 90s that might inform your work?
Yeah, 90s music, I mean, it's, there's, you know, the common theme that I found of it is there's a lot of anger actually in it, whether it's grunge or hip hop. Or, you know, think bands like Rage Against the Machine. There's a lot of, there was very, got very political. Sometimes it was just apathetic. And especially, I mean, hip hop too, there was obviously hip hop that got really famous that was radio friendly, but the stuff that was like really like Nas's Illmatic album, when you listen to that, that's basically like a snapshot. It's like, come spend an hour with me in my life and try to really, really listen and empathize with this. And obviously a lot of people just didn't, they just kind of passed them by. A couple of the more catchy songs caught on, but the music was trying to tell you what was going on in their life and trying to like, almost like, not like ask for help, but just be like, this is how it is. Like is everything isn't, you know, rosy as it is, you know, in your own life. And so, yeah, there's a lot of current of kind of anti-establishment fury there. So,
yeah. Interesting. Okay. So for the readers waiting for your third, maybe they have something to look forward
yeah,
to.
Yeah, it's great for inspiration, but a lot harder to make funny. And ultimately, it's not that I have to going to be like using the music and the actual 90s itself as like a template, because I'll have my own, the world that I've kind of set up for myself. But it's definitely an inspiration, a big inspiration.
How much did the plot inform the character inform the plot? I know it's a cycle. So yeah, how did you do that?
Ultimately, I mean, in the first book is more of the plot, because it's like I said before, it's a very point A to point B kind of story. And the characters had to go there no matter what. Whereas in the second book, the characters inform it a lot more, just because it's very, very, very much their own decisions and their reactions to what happens to them that makes them end up at the final battle. So yeah, obviously it's different for every book. And when writing Kings of the Wild, especially though, I had spent, like I said, 10 years before writing this book that I meticulously planned out and world builded and all drew the map up beforehand, obviously, as a young fantasy writer does. And with Kings of the Wild, I didn't do any of that. I was just like, screw this. I wrote it and it was just character, character, character. No world building. If I had to add a paragraph in here and there, I did. And then luckily, when it got bought, Orbit was in a very, very rare phase of their publishing life when they, for about 6 months, they wanted bigger books as opposed to carving books down smaller, which every publisher does all the time, forever, always. So they just went through about 6 months where they were like, let's make books bigger. And so Kings of the Wild, it was 120,000 words when I finished it, 100,000 words when my editor or my agent finished like paring it down.
Yeah.
And then Orbit wanted 50,000 words added to it.
Wow.
There was some of Clay's backstory was told in flashbacks, which they wanted gone. So that was about 10,000 words. So ultimately it ended up being around 135,000. So I added about 40,000, and ultimately all that extra stuff was a lot of it was world building. A great deal of it was Moog's character as far as having the rot. And then a huge chunk of it was the bad guy, who did not exist in every version again of the book, except for the final one. The original, like, antagonist was just this massive horde of monsters. And it wasn't until the final, like, editing for Orbit that I added this character, Lastleaf, and his whole thing, which thank God I did, because he becomes the catalyst for the entire story afterwards.
Nice. That's interesting how much a story can change after getting your agent, you know, the duration of the agent, and then the book deal where the editors continue. I know you can speak to your experience, but is this a general expectation for writers that are listening and want to get a book deal, that that's what they could anticipate?
And you mean like not adding the words, no.
No.
Like almost, in almost every case, they're going to want it smaller. I've never, ever heard of anyone asking for a bigger book ever. And when I tell people that, they're just like, that is insane. And yeah, I think my agent thought that they were going to try to make it even smaller, which, you know, is usually the case, just because, you know, they're a quicker read. And ultimately, especially with a debut author, a bigger book, you don't kind of think about it, but it takes more money to print. You can put less in a box, and they don't want that. They want to be able to print it easier and send more out. So smaller is better. And for that first book I worked on, for Kings of the Wild, when I first finished it, it was 340,000 words.
Wow.
It was just a monster, which at the time when I wrote it, you know, not I wrote it, didn't write it in the 90s, but I, you know, fell in love with fantasy in the 90s, and the big books then were Wheel of Time and Game of Thrones. And these days in fantasy, at least, Brandon Sanderson can get away with writing massive tomes, but zero other people. I mean, Patrick Rothfuss, obviously, but it just doesn't happen too often.
What about with your subsequent books within the trilogy? Do you have freedom to, like, they go, oh yeah, okay, Nicholas has proved himself. He can do whatever he wants now with these word counts.
I probably could make it a lot bigger. They would definitely try to keep it a bit lower and a bit more, the story a bit more, you know, fast flowing and svelte. But I think the second book ended up being pretty much exactly, like, I want to say that they're 135,000 and 136,000, like, or something very, very close.
Okay.
And when it came to the second book, I'm terrible with deadlines, and I miss my deadline only by a little bit relatively compared to the last deadline I've missed. But when I did finally turn it in, like, I'm pretty meticulous about going over stuff before I hand it in. So there wasn't that many structural edits to go on with the second book. There was just kind of tweaking to go on.
Gotcha. So interesting. That's fascinating to hear. Is Orbit still wanting big books, or are they past that?
Oh, no, they were past it. They were done it like about 6 months after Kings of the Wild. Probably 6 months before it came out. Because there are other books. The only other book I know that also like got 50,000 words added to it didn't do that well, unfortunately. And by all accounts, it's a great book. And I think it was already kind of a big book when it got turned in, and it just got made bigger. And I mean, I have a copy of it, and I haven't read it yet because it is dauntingly big. And so, especially with a debut author, you just don't, you know, and it's not just publishing that wants that. Like, even me, who I love getting stuck into big books, I am kind of still daunted by giant tomes these days, just because my attention span is probably lower and, you know, short on time. So mm-hmm. with an author you don't know yet, you don't want to necessarily take the chance. So
yeah, that's a very good point. I do think that the attention span is shorter generally with the TikTok generation. And mm-hmm. I was listening to Prince Harry's book Spare, and his chapters are really, really short. But I think mm-hmm. that it speaks to like easy, digestible moments in time that you can grab in your very busy life. And so now I'm trying to do something similar with my writing structure. We'll see how I do. But yeah, it does.
Yeah. I think I'm a big fan of short chapters. It's definitely something I tried to do. And I also, like, a tool that I try to use is, obviously it's not with every single chapter, but I'm also a huge fan of like the endings of chapters. Like my favorite author, Guy Gabriel Kay, I used to, before I even read his book, like a new book of his, I would open it up and look at the end of some of his chapters. And he just, every one of them is like a goddamn poem. And so I would try to, you know, make the end of my chapters hit hard. And also because I was writing a book that I wanted to appeal to just, you know, non-fantasy readers as well as fantasy mm-hmm. readers, kind of like cut the chapter before I should, about a page before I normally would. And so it just felt that it was like you'd stumble into the next chapter and then stumble into the next chapter.
Yes.
Hopefully read a few more before you went to bed. So
Well, yeah, it's a strategy that a lot of mainstream thriller novelists use, where each ending hooks you right to go into the next one. And before you know it, you're reading more chapters than you meant. Okay. All right. On the topic of ensembles, writing an ensemble, what was your favorite part about writing about all these characters and how they come together?
I'm a big fan of the quiet scenes between battles. And that goes for both books. And again, it's a thing that's very much inspired by video games like Final Fantasy and Mass Effect. And that's kind of like the quiet moments where they're all sitting around a fire and talking and reflecting and laughing and joking and making fun of each other and getting kind of vulnerable with each other. Those are by far my favorite scenes. And I think they're the scenes that throughout the book, you know, they, as long as you make them interesting and don't make them seem like lulls, they do so much to further a character and to make the moments where they're in dire straits seem more dire. And then you throw one in at the end, like, you know, in Kings of the Wild, there's a moment at the end where the five of them are together for, you know, what may or may not be the last time. And they all, you know, they tell each other they love each other. And to me, that those moments can be little kind of mini climaxes as well. And yeah, they're by far my favorite parts of writing an ensemble. But that said, writing the fight scenes, although I usually hate writing them when I'm in them, they can be fun too, especially when the ensemble in question are, you know, bumbling idiots and well past their prime, because it's like all these pieces trying to fit together disjointedly. So it can kind of be kind of interesting to write as well.
So then what would be the most challenging part writing an ensemble?
Once again, the fight scenes. just because, yeah, almost everyone I've written, I especially like the first one that Saga fights in, the band fights in the first book, they fight this, you know, this chimera. And I remember, oh God, I was writing that and I just thought it was the most awful, stupid scene. I think it's, it lasts for a few chapters, and I felt it was so bogged down and slow. And then I went back and read it, and I was like, oh no, this is fantastic. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, writing the fight scenes can be really hard, fitting all the pieces together. When you're writing just from one, obviously one person's in a fight, it's like their perspective and this happened and this happened and this happened, but trying to kind of balance the timing of the fight and keep it exciting and having the main character have time to look around and see what all the other characters are doing. Just even finding the phrasing for that, how they bought that time for themselves can be challenging sometimes.
What advice do you have for listeners and writers in general who, all right, they're going to tackle an ensemble now and they want to do it well?
I think for a brand new writer, and this isn't necessarily like anecdotal from myself, but like, try to keep it to one POV, even though it's so tempting to do multiple ones. And by all means, disregard this advice, you know, if you want to. But I think a lot of new writers, myself included, I wrote my first, you know, novel that will never be published, had tons of main characters and tons of POVs. And, you know, once again, it was a product of the books I had read when I was a kid, trying to emulate them. And those writers, what we kind of forget is that they had written a lot of other books first, and they were really good at it. And, you know, it is a skill that you develop. And I think it's a lot easier to write from one character's perspective, at least in the beginning, and do it that way. I think a lot of people kind of tend to spread themselves too thin, as it were, in their first attempt. So yeah, just keep it to one person. But yeah, ultimately, yeah, try to make characters empathetic, but not too empathetic if it's not true to their characters. Mm-hmm. and have a lot of those quiet moments in there. There's a series of books, I forget the name of the actual series, but the first book's called Blind Space by an author named Jeremy Zoll, who they're kind of like a sci-fi, they're very much like a Mass Effect kind of books. And he, especially in his second book, has a lot of the same things that I do, is the quiet moments, the drinking together, the events that make them seem like real people, as opposed to just these kind of caricatures, that I think can lend a lot to the characters as they go on.
That's some really great advice. Thank you for sharing that. We have covered a lot on the topic of ensembles. Have I missed anything? Is there anything else you would like to add?
Not necessarily. No. I think that's pretty good.
Okay.
As an exploration of my own work more, say like in my first book, and for those interested, say in reading the second book as well, although the first book, each character is represents, like I said, a member of the band. In my second book, they're representative of genres of 80s music. So one person represents kind of like the punk rock, one's the metal, the hair metal. One's the kind of, literally her name's Cura, and, you know, represents the Cure and goth kind of stuff. And so, yeah, it's a bit different in the second book. So it was a kind of a cool challenge and fun. I think it makes each character kind of very different.
Yeah. And some great Easter eggs as people are reading through and kind of discovering these things.
Yeah. And although you don't like, you know, there's a lot of music references in both books, but the music knowledge is not required whatsoever. My editor, you know, she didn't get any of the references when she read it, which sometimes for the best, because I almost had an agent once that was an older British guy. He got all the references, and they were too much. Which is a fair critique of it as well. So, you know, if you get references, you get them. If you don't, you don't. But there are soundtracks for both books that I've curated on Spotify. With the first book especially, it is a chapter by chapter soundtrack, and very many of the chapters in that book were inspired by music. There's a part where they fight a dragon in the first book, and well, they more just like a runaway from them. But when I was writing that scene, I just could not get it, and I had started it over and over and over. Then finally, one day on the way to work, I was listening to this ZZ Top song called LaGrange, and I was just like, oh, this is the scene. This is how it has to go. And you could now listen to that song and read that scene, and it would beat for beat in the song coincide with what happens in that scene. And so, yeah, music informed a lot of how those scenes work. And the same goes for the climax of the second book, is beat for beat to a very specific Meatloaf song as well. So by no means do you have to listen to the soundtracks, but I think they can only kind of amplify what I was going for.
That's awesome. That's so much fun. All right, Nicholas, how can our listeners follow you, find you, learn more about you?
Well, I'm fairly active on Twitter. I do try to promote a lot of, you know, other fellow authors and artists and things like that on there as well. And then on Instagram as well. I'm a pretty huge reader of like comics and books. And so whenever I'm reading something I enjoy, or even just get sent something from whether it's a publisher or another author, I try to promote as much as I can and just share the things that I love, whether it's TV shows or anime and stuff like that. So yeah, I would say Instagram and Twitter. Facebook, I'm pretty inactive on, and I don't even look at my friends, like new friends thing anymore.
Poor Facebook. I feel like that's just across the board. People have that attitude.
Yeah. It's hard to really let go of because I don't want to lose touch with some old friends, but otherwise, yeah, it's just, I don't scroll down that wall because only evil lies there.
All right. Perfect. Well, thank you so much for joining me. This has been a great conversation and I can't wait to share it with our listeners.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate a lot of great questions. And yeah, for anyone out there, if you read my books or if you've read them or are thinking of reading them, then thank you.
Speculative Sandbox is a volunteer-run podcast that relies on the collaboration of fellow creators like you. Join the conversation and participate in fun polls and questionnaires on TikTok, Instagram, and Twitter. Interested in being in a future episode? Our DMs are open, or you can email speculativesandbox@gmail.com.